Oh, the shape up or get. If you let all the fans down.
Can we not lock this?
It's a fact. I am not playing mind games. I am talking about facts.
I always said if I was Aladicio, they'd probably say I was more of a tactical genius.
The answer questions on anything. Religious, politics, health, you know, sexual problems.
Look at his face! Just look at his face!
None of you, except for those two, have done anything to justify the money that you earn. None of you! Disgrace!
And I suggest you shut up and show more football.
All right, welcome along to Team 33. I am Raf Giallo. As always, you can get in touch with us on Twitter. That's at Team 33. We're also on Facebook and also on iTunes, and some interviews are on YouTube whenever we want to show our faces on that, but that's not every single week. The interview this week is not, but it is Bottled, English Football's Boozy Story, and Benjamin is the author of that. But we have a packed studio as well before we get to all of that. Jonathan Higgins is back.
Hi, guys.
End of call.
How are you?
And Colin Buhig, who has been in with us before, but irregularly.
Hey, lads. Long.
You and well? We've also got a newbie as well, Stephen Bradley.
Good evening, folks. Thanks for having me.
Not that one.
Sorry, we just clarified.
Very excited.
Anytime Shamrock Rovers win, I'm delighted to be associated with them. When they lose, don't tweet me.
Or when he speaks.
Oh, what about he speaks about strikers that may have left?
Again, don't tweet me.
Does that actually happen, though? Do people mistake your Twitter for his?
Welcome to Twitter. Yeah, every time. They just search Stephen Bradley and then insert the swear word of choice.
There's an American singer as well, Alison Becker, who gets referenced to the Liverpool goalie. Yeah. It was a very funny tweet a couple of weeks ago. Yes, thank you guys, my calves are fine.
Yeah. Ronan Mullen gets that quite a bit as well.
The best one, there's an Indian guy with the username at RVP. Weekly, he gets it. Anytime Van Persie was bad for Arsenal or bad for United, just weekly. And he's like, he loves it now. He's got like 25, 30,000 followers.
Well, it's nice to have unique names like some of us do. Particularly growing up in Leitrim, Raf Giallo wasn't that.
So that stood out a bit.
Boohig. Donegal, it's a mistake.
Yeah, Boohig's another mistake. One. There are a lot of calls in Donegal, but I'm not sure how many end of calls and
not too sure how many calls in Donegal I want to be associated with either, Raf.
We'll leave that one there.
So, moving swiftly onwards.
Main interview, anyway, as I said, is Benjamin Roberts' book Bottled, English Football's Boozy Story. But before we get to that, because there are a lot of examples of careers that were kind of either cut short or badly affected by alcohol. There are other careers that have also been cut short for other reasons. Billy Kenny, Colm, I think you wanted to bring up this week.
Yeah, so I read about this guy a few years ago, and Football 365 had this top 10 waste of talent. And this guy, like, you've read about them so much over the years. This typical, like, player, very talented player, falls in love with the drink and steps aside. And like, for me personally, it's always been an interesting topic, but this guy, I don't know what it was about him, but I found him very interesting. So Peter Beardsley, who played with him at Everton, nicknamed him the Goodison Gaza. But I don't know if anyone in this room has heard of him.
Not before you mentioned him. No.
Yeah, it's all shaking heads, like. And I asked people outside this office, no one's really heard of him, but he actually got man of the match in the Premier League's first ever Merseyside derby. So December 1992, Everton played Liverpool at Goodison Park. And Billy Kenny ran the show. And that was in the midfield with Jamie Redknapp, Steve McManaman, John Barnes is up front, Dan Hutchinson played. It was an Everton team that wasn't the best. Martin Keown was playing right back for Everton. And it was Peter Beardsley in wearing number 8, who was really their playmaker. He got the winner that night. And then behind him was Billy Kenny, number 7. And the only footage of him on YouTube is this game. It's extended highlights. It's a VHS tape that's been converted onto YouTube. So, like, the score is 2-1 and all three of the goals are missed live, so they have to show the replay of them. But what they do show is extended highlights of basically the passing around midfield, and you get this guy popping up number 7 all the time, Billy Kenny, he doesn't do anything extraordinary, so to speak, but what he does is he's constantly intercepting through balls or dribbles from McManaman and John Barnes, and then his distribution is just so calm in the kind of chaos of the Merseyside derby. He was seen to be the one guy who just took a breather and had a lot of composure and always found his man. So I suppose that's where you're getting the little bit of the Beardsley, Goodison, Gaz idea. So I read that description about him. I thought, this is really interesting. So I looked him up, and Billy Kenny played a total of 21 times for Everton. So the first year of the Premier League, 92-93, that was his time, really. Everton finished 13th. They had a so-so season. They only had won the league in 1987, the previous time. So this was a really good club at the time. Howard Kendall was in charge, and Kenny went into the team at 17 years of age. He was hugely, hugely rated. But what happened to him the summer of 1993, after his first full season when he played half the games, he did a shin splints, or he got shin splints, I should say, and his shin was, he just could not get over them, as so often is the case, people who get that. So he was out for 6 months. And back in 1993, when you're out for 6 months, you didn't really have the support network that you might have today, or even the distraction of our phones or anything like that. He had nothing to do. So what he did was turn to booze, and he went out with people who thought were his friends. These are his own quotes. He thought they were his friends, but looking back, it was just because he was a well-known Everton player, and exactly, you're making the money, St. Stephen, had a bit of money. And then the drink was one thing, because back then, the 90s, British footballers, drink is fairly ubiquitous. Everyone drank a bit, but the problem was, he got so bored and had so much time in his hands that he turned to drugs, and cocaine was his drug of choice. And what was happening was, 6 months after be one of the most highly rated, highly tipped young English midfielders, the heir to Gaza's throne. This guy was out until 4 or 5 in the morning getting a taxi, sometimes getting a taxi directly from going a night out straight to training, doing a few lines in the back seat, showing up to training and just being completely all over the place. So Howard Kendall left Everton in the second spell. Mike Walker took over from the Norwich manager, and he had absolutely no tolerance at all for this guy whatsoever, for Kenny. So he just shipped him out straight away, didn't care about his talent. He was not into that type of thing at all. He didn't care how naturally gifted Kenny was. He was out the gap. So he went from man of the match, Merseyside derby, to 12 months later, gone. Absolutely gone. He got one England under 21 cap. And the only club that would take him, because he had built such a terrible reputation for those previous 6 months, was Tranmere Rovers. They're the only club who would give him a chance. So yeah, he played four times for Tranmere. He got one own goal. And he obviously continued with everything that he was doing when he was off injured, because he was addicted now. That was the problem. So Oldham had no tolerance for him at all. Four games gone, one on goal to show for himself. That was it. And at 21 years of age, 1994, it was all over for Billy Kenny. Walked out of football. Partly because no club would touch him, partly because he was so horribly and hopelessly addicted to drugs. And there was absolutely no support network. And what was really interesting was, I asked Rafa about this about a week ago, have you ever heard of him? And you kind of looked up in the air, and you were like, I had heard. He fell out of the game completely. And that's exactly what happened to him. That he became a bit of a mystery and no one really knew where he was. And he did an interview in 1998 and he said, like, at that same time, he was still addicted to drugs and drink. And he didn't get clean until late 20s. And he said that he was just in a massive spiral. And it did not matter to him that he was this hotshot Everton player. It did not matter to him that he got man of the match in the Merseyside derby. He just wanted to get better. And there was absolutely nobody there to help him. And to be honest with you, that's where my research stops. Because I don't know where he is to this day. All I know is, by all accounts, from what I've read, is that he's clean now and he's doing his own thing and it sounds like it's okay and he's alive, he's mid-40s, he's doing well. His dad actually played for Everton in the 70s as well by the same name, Billy Kenny Sr. He only played a couple of dozen games as well, but he retired due to injury at 27. Kenny walked out, or was thrown out, whatever way you want to look at it. But as I say at the very start of this conversation, or this monologue, I've heard of so many players like this before. Like, I made a list like Franny Jeffers, Jose Baxter, Michael Ball, players at Everton who didn't make it. But this guy, for whatever reason, his story stood out for me. Maybe it was because of the Merseyside derby man of the match. Maybe it was because at 21, nobody would take a chance at him at all. No matter how talented he was gone. Mm. And it's a guy who I'm going to continue to look into because I find him fascinating. I'd love to track him down. I'd love to get him on, have an interview with him, because I want to know the story from his point of view. But I'll leave it at, if you want to know more about Billy Kenny, type in Billy Kennedy Everton in Google. You'll read a few articles about him. They'll all have the same headline, biggest waste of talent. And there's one clip of on YouTube against Liverpool in December 1992. That's Billy Kenny. It's an amazing story.
Yeah, it's definitely fascinating. So that actually brings us neatly then to Benjamin Roberts' book, Bottled English Football's Boozy Story. So I was chatting to him last week, but here's the full interview.
All right, delighted to be joined by Benjamin Roberts, author of Bottled English Football's Boozy Story. So that just came out this month. And obviously, the drinks industry and football have had a long history. And this book kind of takes us through a lot of what has been going on over the years. Benjamin, I guess maybe to start off, even from when you look at the way the English FA was set up, the fact that it was actually founded in a pub kind of tells you where this, how these two kind of areas of life interact.
Yeah, it certainly does. And so you had a situation where, as you say, the FA, the Football League in 1888 was set up in a pub as well. And so you had a situation in the very sort of earliest when clubs were kind of coming together, they tended to be either sort of works teams or church teams or sort of social clubs in some way. But very quickly, it became apparent that football was something that you could make money out of, or at least, you know, you could use it for advertising or promoting your product. So these teams would come out of those social institutions, and then breweries and pubs thought, actually, we can get in on the act here, and perhaps sponsor the team or have the team be owned by us. So particularly in the North England's northwest and the Midlands, which is where a lot of these teams, especially the working class teams, were. And so around that sort of 1888, 1890s time, that was when pubs and breweries wanted to get in on the act, and they might help finance the building of a stadium or pay off some of the club's debts. And that would allow them to then run the bars in those stadiums, perhaps put their name across the roof of a stadium, paint their name across. And a lot of them, you got to remember that, sort of in this period in the late 1800s, there was so many more pubs than there are now. So if they had, I don't know, half a dozen pubs in a particular district, and that was where the ground was, it made sense for them to be involved in the team, because they had so many of their premises around.
Yeah, and obviously we're kind of talking toward the tail end of the Industrial Revolution, so there's two aspects here. So there's factory acts, and it has an effect on both football and obviously pubs, because it reduces the amount of time people have to spend in work due to health and safety, etc. So there's maybe two competing sides trying to, I guess, on one side churches, etc., and then the drinks industry as well through pubs, trying to bring people in and maybe control, I suppose, what they're doing outside of work.
Yeah, so the Factory Act meant that people, a lot of working people, by no means all, but a lot of working people suddenly had a Saturday afternoon free, and that was great for them. But there were some sort of figures in the churches that thought, well, actually, what are they going to do? I think there was one churchman that was saying, you know, they're just drinking themselves into a state of riot, dissipation and drunkenness. And what can we do about it? And there was a sort of qualified response from the churches, particularly the non-conforming churches in the north of England, that said, well, we're not entirely sure about this game of football, but look, it's something else that they can do. They can play, or they can go and watch. And if they're going to watch, they might still be drinking, but they're doing something else as well. And it sort of slows down what they're doing. And then you had some churchmen, and some of those were involved in the FA and the Football League. So you had people like William McGregor and Charles Sutcliffe. So William McGregor was the guy sort of known as the father of the Football League. And he believed that, well, actually, this is a good thing, because while they're playing football, they're not drinking, and perhaps we can sort of chart them on a godly path by occupying them with this, and it stops them just going straight down the pub at 12:01 when they finish work.
Yeah, and there seemed to be a trend as well, I guess, in the early 20th century, where certain premises would try and encourage ex-footballers in particular to become tenants as well.
Yeah, and that was a really common practice, really, until just after the Second World War. And it was a really lucrative practice for those ex-footballers. And you had to have been a pretty good one. But if you were, then you'd draw quite a crowd into the pub, and obviously that was a plus for the breweries as well, because there was the sort of brewing industry was a lot more stratified at that time, so there was a lot of competing businesses. So if you could get this really great footballer who'd played 10 years at his club, then perhaps for the next decade after he retired, he could take on that pub, manage that pub, and as far as everyone was concerned, it was a win-win.
Yeah. In terms of the actual sponsorship, say on jerseys and things, obviously that came much later on, but it was interesting just in the book you talk about Eintracht Braunschweig and their link up with Jägermeister. So that was I get would I be right in saying that's kind of like the first time, at least in one way, that a club tried to at least get the logo on a jersey.
Yeah, so that was in Germany, as you say, Eintracht Braunschweig, and so they were sort of a fairly lowly team, not a lot of money, and some debts that needed paying, the proprietor of Jägermeister sort of realized this. He wasn't a football fan by any means, but he realized, well, he was at a party, I think, and or perhaps a party he'd put on, and people kept disappearing, and he was, you know, what are they doing? And it turned out they were all going to watch a match on TV in some other room. He thought, well, if this is distracting people so much, then maybe I should get in on this. So he sort of proposed that the club would have the Jägermeister logo on, but the DFB, the German FA, were not keen on this at all. There was no sponsorship at all on shirts at the time. So he thought, well, how can we get around this? Perhaps we can get rid of the deer that was Braunschweig's logo, and we can put the Jägermeister stag there instead. Yeah. The DFB still weren't happy about this, and they sort of imposed a lot of rules about how big the logo could be and so on and so forth. But eventually they managed to get that through, and it sort of precipitated then other clubs in the Bundesliga taking on sponsorship. I think Campari might have sponsored another club not too long after that. So something that, you know, we sort of see now, where betting companies are making a sort of a play of, well, you know, we sponsor this club, but the sponsor's not going to be on there, with Huddersfield, for example, this year. So we're seeing a few shirts without sponsors on now for a different reason. But at the time, it was completely normal for there not to be a sponsor there.
Yeah, and then obviously naming rights and everything else come in, particularly in England with trophies and certain things. But I wanted to fast forward very quickly to the 1990s, because it's a time where I think the issue of alcoholism within the game is spoken about a lot more openly. Obviously, Jimmy Greaves had spoken about it much earlier, but there's a few incidents involving the England team. You might just talk us through the dentist chair story as well, because I kind of remember it a bit from the time, but for those who might not be aware of it, because time has obviously passed since.
Yeah, so a few weeks before Euro 96, and England go over to Hong Kong to play some local sides and to play some friendlies. And while they're there, the team go out for a drink, and they're sort of sent along with Brian Robson to supposedly keep an eye on them, make sure they stay out of trouble. And a number of the players then end up going into an adjoining room of the bar in Causeway Bay in Hong Kong, and find this sort of dentist chair contraption where they could just basically pour spirits down each other's necks. And of course, that leaks out to the press over the days that followed that. And then becomes one of their sort of jokey celebrations during the tournament. But it sort of, it was seen as a signifier of a, well, the sort of loutishness or the supposed loutishness of the England team at that time, but really also the state of drinking in England as a whole at that time, and the Americans had sort of calmed down their drinking a bit, but there was a sort of burgeoning kind of moral panic that kind of really came to a head in the mid-2000s about how much England as a nation was drinking.
Yeah, but I'm going to just hazard a guess here. It's not like drinking consumption had particularly changed, had it? It was just maybe there was more of a, I suppose, an acknowledgement of binge drinking?
Yeah. Yeah, I think it was something that had been going on for a while. Certainly, drinking patterns had changed quite a lot between the 50s and 70s, gone up quite a lot. But it was something that was a lot less remarked upon And then as the 80s creeps into the 90s, and by the mid 90s, it's like, well, actually, we've been doing this for a long time, but now we're worried about it.
Yeah, and then obviously 1998 again, a similar issue, but it's just Paul Gascoigne, who we of course know has had many problems with drink over the years, and this involves Chris Evans and Danny Baker, and it culminates in obviously being left out of the World Cup squad as well. And for those who probably don't remember it, can you just talk us through that one?
Yeah, so Paul Gascoigne, who'd obviously been involved in the dentist chair stuff a few years before, so we're in 1998 now, and he's obviously hoping to go, and Glenn Hoddle has made individual appointments with each of the players across the Sunday to tell them whether they're in or out. And just before Gascoigne goes in, he gets wind that he's not going, because he kind of looks at Glenn Rhoda, and Glenn Rhoda's eyes kind of tell him that that's the case. So he barges in to somebody else's appointment with Hoddle and sort of loses it, basically. That's knocking things over, chucking things around, and it sort of becomes this again, this sort of signifier of his declining state. You know, I think he'd taken a transfer from Rangers to Middlesbrough late in the season before to try and get in the squad, and then he doesn't make it. With him there that day were Tony Adams, who'd quit drinking 6 or 7 weeks after Euro 96, and Paul Merson, who had had his own battles that sort of came to a head for a time at the end of 1994. So they'd so earlier that day tried to calm Gascoigne down. They chucked him in the swimming pool, and ultimately those two go, and Gascoigne doesn't. And for Merson, that's something of a redemption, having been left out of Terry Venables' squad in 1996, where he'd been in one of Venables' squads perhaps in early 94, and was perceived to have let himself down, despite England winning the game, I think 5-0. So for Merson, this is really a return to form, just as Gascoigne is declining there.
Yeah, and obviously the two you mentioned there, Adams and Merson, being part of Arsenal's infamous Tuesday night club, and obviously being around Gaz as well, particularly Merson, who I think shared a house with him at Middlesbrough at one point as well. It's just interesting that they were able to kind of get out of it, whereas Gascoigne went in the other direction.
Yeah, I think, you know, there's lots that can be said about that, really. Paul Merson's own story kind of came to a point in 1994 where there was gambling, there was cocaine, there was drink, and he was told by the club, told by Arsenal, well, you haven't really got a choice here. You're either going to go to rehab or you're not going to play for the club. And it seems that firm hand had a positive effect, certainly at the time, on Paul Merson. And when he kind of reflects back in his own memoirs about that time and about Paul Gascoigne, when they were both at Middlesbrough and when Merson had actually left Middlesbrough, but was still getting calls from figures in the club, and he was really suggesting that a firm hand was the right approach for him, and would be the right approach for Paul Gascoigne as well.
Yeah, but like, there's obviously the case of Jimmy Greaves as well, who spoke openly about his issues as well in the 80s. So it wasn't exactly, or 70s into the 80s.
Late 70s.
Yeah, so it wasn't something that was completely unknown within the game, at least from people outside of it.
Not at all, no. So Greaves is seen as the first player to really come out as an alcoholic in that way. And his story of alcoholism really begins more or less just as he's finishing as a player at West Ham. But it's when he finishes as a player, he retires, and football is all he's known. And then for 2 years, he doesn't have anything to do with football. He doesn't kick a ball. He doesn't do anything. And it sort of begins this slide for him into the sort of the depths of his alcoholism. Eventually, he goes to Alcoholics Anonymous, which he'd sort of been going to before, but had been skeptical of. But he ends up on his own in a bedsit, estranged from his wife. And that's when it really takes hold for him. And obviously, you know, enjoyed sobriety since then.
Yeah, and of course the game has changed. First, obviously, Wenger coming in at Arsenal at that time. Obviously, Adams and Merson stayed on as well. But the you know, the Tuesday Night Club became a thing of the past. And then Alex Ferguson coming into Manchester United in the 1980s, that's another change. And we had Paul McGrawen recently in an event, and he jokingly made the point that a couple of, you know, that he and Norman Whiteside were kind of thrown out of the club, and he kind of said it jokingly. But so there were changes in terms of managers coming in and clamping down then.
Absolutely, yeah. So Ferguson comes in, and actually it takes a while for him to change that dressing room culture. I think he's there good two and a half years before Whiteside and McGrath get their transfers. But he's taken over from Ron Atkinson, who was known for having a very, very relaxed attitude to players drinking. You know, as long as they turn up and play on the pitch and do well, then, you know, that's none of my business kind of thing. Whereas Ferguson has come in with a reputation from Scotland, from Aberdeen, from St Mirren, as being that sort of hard taskmaster. I think it was when he was at Aberdeen, and he hears he's getting a taxi back from a night match, and then he hears on the taxi sort of intercom thing another taxi being called to the stadium to pick up some of his players to take them to a nightclub. So he gets his own taxi to turn around and reads them the Riot Act, and he's sort of famous quotes from Ferguson, basically along the lines of, look, you know, drink should have no part in the life of an athlete. You know, it's a stain on the British game as far as he's concerned.
Yeah, and it's not even just the athlete, because then you, of course, as I mentioned Wenger earlier, I remember reading stories over the years where he might eschew the post or the traditional post game or post match glass of wine. But one manager who did have issues towards the end of his career was Brian Clough. And you kind of detail it in the book, and it became apparent really in the final season.
Yeah, so he'd obviously had an incredible career at Forest, you know, won two European Cups, but in that final season, sort of just around when the Premier League's coming in, and Forest just have this dismal season. They sort of barely win, you know, 10 games or something like that. A lot of that, I think even he can see in hindsight, in the memoirs he released, perhaps a couple of years before his death, that actually he'd had a part to play in that. His involvement with the team had become quite minimal, just sort of turning up for a training session on a Friday and then for the match on a Saturday, and really not having the grip on it that he had before. And the game had kind of moved on, and he hadn't moved on with it, and part of that can perhaps be put down to his relationship with the bottle, particularly in those last few years.
Yeah, and I suppose a final question before we let you go. It appears it's issues like gambling and other things like that seem to be the major problem now, and alcoholism or just, you know, issues around drink don't seem to be as prevalent within the game. Would that be fair to say?
Yeah, so I, as part of the book, I spoke to some people at Sporting Chance, which was the clinic that Tony Adams set up after he'd been sober for a few years. And, you know, with the way the game is today, it would be very difficult to be drinking a lot and playing, because the effect of that drinking, heavy drinking, would be immediately obvious. A lot of addictive disorders can be kind of transferable, and for certain people, while they're playing, and while the season's on, that might transfer to something like gambling, which, you know, as we all know, is something these days that you can do on your phone. You can do it away from prying eyes. So I think in the active playing population, certainly gambling is the major issue of the day. It would tend to be in the retired playing population now, where players that might have just binged for a month at the end of a season, suddenly they're retired. Quite often the marriages break up not too long after they've retired because their whole lifestyle has changed, and they can kind of slip into some tricky situations as far as alcohol is concerned.
Yeah, but certainly it's an interesting kind of facet of the game, probably one that hasn't been really touched on too much bar the individual stories. So Benjamin, thanks a million for your time. The book is Bottled, English Football's Boozy Story, and it's out now.
Thanks.
All right, so that is Benjamin Roberts, author of Bottled, English Football's Boozy Story, and you can find that interview in full on the podcast as well, or if you go to OTB Sports Radio, you'll find that there. Next week, the interview, by the way, as well, will be with Colin Miller, author of The Frying Pan of Spain, Sevilla v Real Betis, so it's all about that derby, and I was quite deliberate in picking this book as well to do, because I used to live there too.
I was about to say, it's a real trip down memory lane for you.
100%, yeah. It's only, well, what is it, 10, 11 years ago, but still kind of remember the place very, very fondly. So it's always good to do. So we learned about Billy Kenny and obviously the whole issue of alcohol and the drinks industry in football. But the thing we wanted to talk about actually as well, Stephen, because obviously you're coming in here for the first time. Usually first time people, we get them to set a bit of an agenda. You wanted to talk about kind of loan signings and this whole new trend that's coming in.
It's been a weird transfer window as a whole, you know, even just from an Arsenal side, where Arsenal were told in the middle of summer, yeah, they've only got 45 million to spend, and then suddenly turned five loaves and two fishes into a bounty. You know, Nicolas Pepe, David Luiz, and etc. But there hasn't been that frenzy of, oh my God, X club has spent this. You know, Barcelona did spend 120 on Griezmann, but it was a release clause. It wasn't exactly a transfer bid, and they've got money back in. Now look at Coutinho, for example. You know, they hawked him around to every club in Europe, and everyone pretty much went, not really. Like, we were 2 weeks away from him being on Gumtree. You know, like, it's a case of, and then Bayern Munich go, do you know what? Yeah, look, okay, we'll take him. But you can see it in their official statement on Twitter, don't tell anyone how much we paid.
That was really, really insightful, really, was the fact that Bayern Munich were like, no, both clubs have agreed not to release it. While at the same time, Barcelona were like, he's gone for 100, and, you know, the loan fee, and, you know, with a chance to buy him for 110 million this season
because
afterwards.
There's only ever one time you don't want anyone to know how much you've paid for something.
When you are Barcelona, you're skint.
No. When you've paid too much for it. That's when you get the, oh yeah, we bought him for an undisclosed fee. You know, there's none of that. You know, when Liverpool sold Coutinho, it was like Barcelona, yeah, don't let it. Oh no, it was 140 million. It was. No, absolutely it was. And now we found out that's about 105.
Remember,
it was all in
Arsenal always used to be good for the undisclosed fee. Yeah. I never used to know how much they signed
that
players for.
Double sale of Petit and Overmars to Barcelona.
Oh, yeah.
For 30 million. And it turned out Overmars went for 25.
Wasn't Andre Gomez's permanent transfer to Everton this summer the only disclosed fee in the Premier League?
Yeah.
And every other one was either loan or undisclosed. Undisclosed is the hottest property these days for transfers.
You can just
do what you want for that undisclosed.
Well, you can kind of, the technical term is cook the books, but you can be a bit more lenient with your,
and we just accept it.
Yeah, because both parties feel like they've got the best out of the deal then. And
well, you know, not to go all Swiss ramble on us here, because our man's magnificent on Twitter, but it's amortization. It is literally cooking the books. It's pushing the contract value 5 years down the line and hoping to God that no one picks up on it. But now, with all these loans with options to buy and et cetera, it looks like finally football is looking through its wallet and going, uh-oh. In the same way we look at our paychecks at 29th in the month, we're going, can we stretch this out to the first, lads? And they're looking at it and going, maybe, maybe not. Because now everyone's, you know, keeping themselves in check. You know, Gareth Bale could have went to anywhere. He ended up going to China. And then Real Madrid went, well, are we going to get a transfer fee? And they're like, no. Well, why not? Because we're paying Gareth Bale £1 million a week. That's why. You know, like Ronaldo goes to Juventus for only 100 million because they had to pay Cristiano Ronaldo 44 million a year.
That's like, true. I'll try Alexis Sanchez to Man United was a free transfer, but nobody talks about that because of his outrageous salary.
Yeah.
So no one thought it's a swap deal with Mkhitaryan.
His outrageous salary, which is 300 grand a week, but sterling, plus bonuses.
Yeah.
Mesut Ozil is 350 grand a week, basic.
I thought Sanchez was on more.
No.
Jeez.
And that's the problem Arsenal have now with Pierre-Emerick Aubameyang, because Aubameyang has gone, look, I've got 2 years left in the contract. I think I deserve Ozil's wages, don't you? And Arsenal have gone, yeah, but you may earn them.
But the biggest mistake Arsenal made was bowing to Ozil, I think, at that rate and give him that absurd wage.
But they had to.
They didn't. I would have just let him go. As it turns out, it's just distorted. It's put too many bad... As you said, there's people looking around the dressing room going, you know, I should be on the same. How does he get as much as I do? And that led to Ramsey leading. And is, if you look at it as a whole, it's done more good or done more bad than good when you look at it
and
as a whole.
This happened at Arsenal for a decade. Like, it's not like Mesut Ozil pulled this trick over Arsene Wenger. Theo Walcott did it twice.
Signed the thing.
Yeah, signed the thing. And he did it for 60 grand. And then 3 years later, he did it for 110. Danny Welbeck was on 115 grand a week.
Yeah.
Really. Like the amount of like mediocre players Arsenal have given non-mediocre wages to is unbelievable, and now it's catching up on them. But now they have to pay it because they need to get top four money. And the more clubs when they budget for Champions League and don't get it, you're now looking at AC Milan, who deliberately took themselves out of the Europa League and took a 1 year penalty because they want to make sure they pass FFP next year. You've got Lille in France, who deliberately took Arsenal's lesser offer. Because it was in installments, because FFP in France is judged by the year and not by a 3 year payment. So that, or 3 year cycle, so that it's actually beneficial for them to get 20 million a year.
Mm.
We had to, Arsenal sold Alex Iwobi for 28. Yeah, Legion slipped there, Paul.
No. there's a lot of different Legions in here.
But Arsenal spent 2 months trying to get Kieran Tierney on 5 million plus 10 plus 10 and couldn't do it. Celtic went, no, we want 25 million up front because we think he's as good a left back as Andy Robertson. He might be. If he gets fit, but he could be. And Celtic went, we want 25 million for him. Eventually, they got it. For Arsenal to raise that, they had to sell Alex Iwobi. So the amount of clubs that are, you know, juggling these finances, we might be reaching the point where actually football is spent enough.
Mm.
And the only way from here now is down. And as soon as, you know, footballers get to the end of their contracts and they go, because they're used for 20 years for exponential rises in wages, as soon as it starts going, yeah, we can't afford this, you have to start taking a pay cut, there's trouble coming.
Are we talking about a bubble bursting here overall?
Yes. Like I said, if Gareth Bale leaves, if he stays on Real Madrid's bench for 3 years on his £480,000 a week net, is he getting that in 3 years? No. But what does he do? Does he take 150 grand a week? You know, a quote-unquote pay cut to go where he wants? Or does he go, do you know what, lads? I've had enough. I'm going to go play golf.
Like, stay. Do that.
Yeah, that's my point. Like, so that's Gareth Bale gone out of the game at 31.
You know, but he's achieved everything he's going to achieve, though.
Yeah. Really.
But my point is, Gareth Bale we know is gone anyway.
Yeah, but my point is, how many footballers are going to make that decision at 31 instead of taking what they think is a lesser wage and just going, do you know what, lads?
But look at the influx. Just pick the Chinese league, for instance. Look through the squad list. It's kind of, oh yeah, I remember watching him play. These are all young players, almost some at the peak of their careers, are definitely not over the hill where they're going, picking up huge amounts of money.
Paulinho. Who went to Barcelona, won the Champions League, and went back for more money.
But look, Mascherano's over there. The list is endless. It's not in a case of, it's almost because the who's who at this stage, really. And that's all money. That's distorted that. It's given people a huge alternative, and where they mightn't be that focused on the game or whatever to stay in Europe or whatever. Now they have an alternative to go.
Do you know what I want to know? That line there, the Gareth Bale that we know is gone. When did he go?
He was really good on Saturday.
Yeah, so score the winner at the weekend.
He has redefined his role a little bit in the last couple of years. He's definitely not the powerhouse fast winger getting down. Like I would say the Gareth Bale we knew changed when he was shifted over to the right wing, because then he turned into an inverted winger instead of being the guy who's getting the ball, driving at the defence, and getting in behind, scoring lots of goals, getting crossed into the box.
At Tottenham, he was basically it's like a 10-year-old in the best player in a schoolyard team. That's it's like, here, you have the ball.
But even that, his role's changed. You go back to that Inter Milan game where he has the ball and he does literally no skill whatsoever. Boot the ball 15 yards in front of Maycon and then punts up and just burns.
Twice,
yeah.
Right stick and analog and gone.
He's arguably a better player now.
Oh, definitely.
Because the Gareth Bale, like, who played against Inter Milan, isn't scoring that bicycle kick against Tottenham.
Yeah,
or against Liverpool, sorry, in the Champions League final.
He's a better player, but like the player that he's become now is like a substandard version of where he's filling in for everybody else in that level, in that elite level. But like, you missed that type of Gareth Bale back then. But is there room for that Gareth Bale in modern football? The guy who just
no one's
gonna fall for it.
That Gareth Bale would almost be a wing back.
You know, it's like when James McLean first came through at Sunderland, and he was absolutely
brilliant.
Yeah.
He's a high octane James McLean.
Maybe it's unfair to say one dimensional, but he was
was.
The left wing back is end of call. That's exactly where he'd be now.
Traore last night comes on in the second half for Wolves and plays that game. Okay, just a sprinter on the win.
Can I interest you in paying £400,000 a week for an inverted left wing back? That's the problem. Like, he's still a great player, but no one's going to pay that for someone who's going
to play. It's the wages. It's just the wages issue that you have, and I go back to it again. That unrest that it causes in the camp. Technically, as a player, he will fit into. I don't know if he's going to fit into the top end teams. Your Guardiolas, your Potticinos, your Klopps, where it's that high octane. Everyone has to press. He's probably doesn't have the legs to do
if
that anymore.
If only there were a club that used to be really good that have really disastrously messed up their wage structure in the last couple of years that would have a history in maybe the last 5 years of signing players that
would they wear red?
Might have been over the hill slightly and obnoxiously big wages. No, I can't think of anybody at the minute, to be honest.
Wait,
top of head.
That club has loads of right wing on a weight.
Hold on though, like Gareth Bale has had an unbelievable career.
Yeah. Incredible.
Yes. Like statistically, like
the way,
incredible.
The way
career.
He is
but he's so hated. Like,
the way he has been treated by Real Madrid is absolutely
I think
ridiculous.
Some of that is to his
what
own
is that,
I think some of that is down to his own self as well because he's gone, I don't care.
But here's the
he
thing.
He just doesn't go to dinner with them.
Yeah, he just doesn't want to eat at 10 o'clock at night. Is that
I know, is that I think it's more than that. And some of the this, like you're probably referring to the Zidane stuff where he's saying, I've told him go. I think that I can see that other point. While it's probably wrong to go to those extremes, that's because he's told them, go. And Bale's gone, no, I'm just going to play golf.
But to be fair, though, to be fair to Zidane and to Real Madrid in general, it's an absolute toxic club.
Oh, it's
like, and it's not just Bale. Like, we kind of live in a bubble where Bale is what's talked about because he's a Welshman playing in Spain and he's a big player. He used to be a big Premier League player. So he's obviously the one that's getting reported on. That's what we're interested in. But I remember I went to a Real Madrid game in the Champions League a few years back and Ronaldo was booed for 80% of the game by the Real Madrid fans and then he scored a last minute free kick to win it and then they were celebrating.
And that's the problem. He was brought in to be the next Ronaldo and that is an impossible
and he never really pushed on that opportunity. I don't think, absolutely nobody's ever going to get to
that, but he wears red and blue.
But nobody's ever, in Real Madrid terms, nobody's ever going to come to that level that Ronaldo had because he's just elite, out of this world.
And that's why Bale is
never
talked
seen.
About
but
in,
I think
that, in that light.
Bale had an opportunity to push on, not be that complete main man, but still to be a bit more of a key asset. I think he did kind of, himself and Zidane falling out, like you go back to the story that I keep referencing, after the Champions League finally scores two goals, he scores probably the best goal I've ever seen in the flesh, arguably one of the best goals you'll ever see in a European Cup final. And Zidane doesn't speak to him in the dressing room. You know, there's that sort of kind of the two of them add up together, and you can see that, okay, this was a bit of a missed opportunity because I think he was still, I think, in the Real Madrid good terms. Everybody, he was still that little kind of golden boy. There was an opportunity there to push on, and he kind of slipped back a bit, and the club as a whole just went completely toxic then.
Yeah, I do want to go back to the whole China discussion that we're having just before we went back to Gareth Bale. And what I found interesting was at the time when China were coming in with all this money to begin with, and I remember having a massive argument with with friends of mine about why people would choose to go to China, like why a 24-year-old would go to China instead of ploughing on. And I can't remember what specific player it was, but it was a young enough player still, and he was going to go to China instead of taking a move to Juventus. And I couldn't get my head around it, but the argument the other players were making was, or the other lads were making, was that we all think that people in Brazil and people in Argentina, these players, these South American players who generally do go to Brazil or go to China, why they would take that over the Premier League. And they don't dream of coming to the Premier League.
Exactly.
They dream of coming out of the favelas and getting out of the slums and making a life for themselves. And if they get offered 350k a week to do that,
why not?
Why not? Why would you take that over the Premier League?
Like, our dream, our job is talking to one of these. If I knew Chinese and they went, look, Stephen, we want you to be on our sports show, we'll pay you 20 grand a week. Thanks, Al. Yeah. I'm off. You know, like, and that's, you know, that's not a thing to be worried. Oh, he's only going there for the money. You're damn right, yeah. I am. You know.
But Gareth Bale's an exception to that because he's already on crazy wages. Anyway, that when you get to the stage where you're earning 400k, after tax.
Yeah, how much more do you need? Yeah.
Does 500 grand or 600 grand a week after tax, does that make that noticeable a difference to your bank account?
No.
But he was going to go.
He was going to go.
Yeah.
But I think he's out of love with the game, really. He was so.
Yeah, well, we don't know that, though. Everyone's putting words in his mouth. Okay. Like, he doesn't love it anymore. But how do we know
he's
that?
He's going to do a great BT Sport interview with Jake Humphries.
Yeah.
When he's sitting there. Do you know what they do after the show?
In the golf cover, in the buggy or something like that.
With Robin Van Persie at the weekend. He's going to do a great one of those 7-minute videos.
Just go completely viral. But I think, okay, going out of the game is probably following the love of the game is probably a bit too over much. But the relationship with Zidane is gone. That's his club manager. Yeah. That can't make playing for Real Madrid fun for him.
Look, unless the guy is just technically not up to it behind the scenes, even in training that Zidane sees, and maybe that's his problem. But if the problem with Bale is as reported that he doesn't socialise with the players, doesn't go, like Roy Keane didn't go to David Beckham's wedding when he was at United, but no one cared, like, because it was Roy Keane. And just because Bale isn't like a ferocious personality and maybe a bit quiet and arguably doesn't, you know, he hasn't learned Spanish. I don't know what his effort levels are. Maybe he can't, maybe he won't. But like, it sounds to me, it's like they're minor offences.
They're highlighted because of the other issues. And
what are the other issues?
The other issues is, as I said, he hasn't pushed on. He hasn't filled that hole. He's on from a Real Madrid point of view. If you're a fan or supporter of that club, you see someone that has huge potential, huge talent. You've witnessed some of the amazing goals. You go back to those El Clasico goals when he first moved. That one where he skips down the wing is almost two rows in the stand and still comes around and smashes it in the bottom corner. They see all that, and then they see the huge wage that he's on, and then you have the PR spin and all that from the club coming out from Zidane that he isn't making an effort and he's not playing, and then he's willing to take that move to China. Yes, you are going to be frustrated if you're in that scenario.
At the same time, he's done enough to be a club legend.
Yeah.
Club
he should be.
And then some.
Final goals, and then some.
Everything. Yeah, and then some as well.
Yeah, absolutely. But it's Real Madrid you're talking about.
I know, you're right. But they should have bought him for Gareth Bale, not to be Cristiano Ronaldo's replacement.
When you're going up against Zidane at Real Madrid, there's only one winner. Even though Gareth Bale has achieved more at Real Madrid than Zidane did, and he has been a key factor in more success than Zidane was at Real Madrid, Zidane is still seen as the original Galactico.
Even after buying Figo out of Barcelona, Beckham from Madrid, Ronaldo, all the like Roberto Carlos, etc. He is like, if you think of the Galacticos, your first image is him scoring that volley against Bayer Leverkusen.
Yeah, I just think that team that Zidane was in is probably more fondly remembered though than the one that has just come through and won three in a row. Because most people still say the Barcelona Pep Guardiola is better and will live on longer in the memory 100%. Than Real Madrid.
Real Madrid are the bad guys in the narrative, and Barca play the good guy football.
I'm not saying they fluked their way to three Champions League titles.
But they're a machine.
Yeah.
But like, Zidane is the most romanticised footballer of the modern era because everything he does is so grand, and the biggest stage, like the Champions League final volley. You know, Bale's one was arguably better. That's another bone of contention.
It was better.
Do you think it was better?
Yeah.
I loved Zidane's.
I idolized that one for years at the one at Hamilton Park.
I think more players could do Bale's than Zidane's.
But Bales was just like, wow. I remember being at the fire.
It was
the fire under the ground going, what the hell has happened? And you look up and see the replay and you're like,
I just burst out laughing.
Yeah, of course. Yeah, and it was one of those goals where you, as a football fan,
that's a great discussion, actually. What goals made you burst out laughing? Because Rooney's volley against Man City. But you saw it live like that.
Yeah, and it was just like, you're gutted. You're at the other end of the stadium, but you're just clapping it. There's nothing you can acknowledge. Just what a goal. I probably will never see a better goal, better live in the flesh.
The one that made me burst out laughing was Henry again. I was in the North Bank for Henry against Charlton, where he just backheeled it.
Oh, yeah.
And then we were looking at the screen, we're like, how did he score that? And then we looked at the big screen and we're like, that doesn't tell us anything.
Is that just a close range flick? Is it?
Yeah. Back heels it through the defender's legs and the goalkeeper's legs in it.
All right. Well, he had some important moments. Yeah, it's like the November 2009. It's like in between the 15th.
It's like in between the 15th and 20th best goal he's ever scored for Arsenal. Yeah. But he's just the one who's like, lads, that's just taking it.
Yeah. But there's goals that you go, like I think the one last night for us all, and you saw with United fans as well, where everyone's just going, wow, it's up and down off the bar. It's just incredible goal. There's, football does that to you every now and again, where you just go, wow, as much. And he's like that one for the Bales one, like it couldn't be more of a sickener result against you. Like, talk about a battle to get over to Gave just and travel all the way over. And then you see that and you just have to go, wow, this is what football is all about.
Just on Ruben Neves, if any followed at Duncan Alexander, the lad with BBC stats, he's brilliant. He had a wonderful nugget. Ruben Neves has scored 5 goals outside the penalty box since he was in the Premier League last season. He's touched the ball inside the box 3 times.
Yeah.
Wow.
He's very much classic. Doesn't have the... Yeah.
What? That's 100% a stat. Yeah. Bloody hell.
So he's the opposite of Ruud van Nistelrooy.
Yes.
But Nistelrooy had a little seat that he got up over every now and again just to tap the ball in. Was the ultimate finisher.
He scored one career goal against Fulham
against the World League. He bet like 7 lads dribbling past it.
He had it in him. He actually was physically strong and quick and everything else. But he just didn't feel the need to kind of.
No, I'll sit here and I'll just tap it in. But what an ultra number 9.
Yeah, we talked about VAR last week, so I don't really want to go into it. But just the moment with Ruben Neves just after it, where they're checking, it does kind of ruin the moment slightly.
It's like I said, I'm
coming around to it.
It suspects it. The VAR makes the right decisions, and who am I to argue with somebody who's watching something in 4K ultra replay? But it ruins the spectacle.
Like, yeah, but we don't make this argument in rugby. We sit and wait.
But rugby only.
I have to say, rugby is not a spectacle.
Yeah. Whoa. Yes. Yes.
Step away from that grenade.
That is something I can get on board with.
No,
thank you.
I 100% stand by it, and you can quote me on it. So
it's the same with tennis. Raph,
the door's out over here.
But there's a great shot in tennis.
But tennis, you only have a certain amount of chances.
Okay.
You can only challenge it a couple of times.
Same with cricket. But now everyone's gone, okay, that's a great effort. Right, we'll wait. Football, as it's turned out for the last couple of weeks, has gone, we don't want to wait. We want to celebrate now. Let us celebrate.
I don't know. Like
you can celebrate when it goes in and then, oh, they're checking VAR. Okay. Oh, it's still a goal. I'm going to celebrate again.
But if you're comparing it to a spectator sport, tennis, you're maybe, oh, that's a great shot.
Agreed.
But great one, old boy. And then... rugby.
So far now, rugby and tennis. Who's next on the list to get slaughtered here?
Wimbledon's only on once a year. You know that everywhere else is played usually. But no,
you can't recreate the carnage of a 90th minute winner. The feeling.
Look, you do lose the spontaneity. I agree, but
no, they can't.
Do we want it to be right or not?
Yeah, that's the question.
Would you rather lose the spontaneity or say that City bet Spurs 3-2?
It depends.
I'm torn on it as well.
The City one for me. That's not a handball.
Well, it is.
Yeah, but again, but it hits his hand.
It's not a problem.
That's the rule. That's the problem with the rule.
Yeah, that's the old that drives you mad. That is the rule, not VAR. VAR is.
But I'm not saying it's VAR. But it is the rule. But the rule is wrong. That's not a handball.
Well, I'm surprised there wasn't more of an uproar when the rules were released in the summer, because you could see that this kind of thing was going to happen
it's
more and more.
Double standards.
Yeah.
Because
absolutely.
If the attacker handles it, the amount of people penalized
that are in the game and watching the game that didn't realize that rule and only came into play was just about laughing. Like, hold on, lads.
Well, they've made a load of rule changes over the summer.
Or VAR. Just to take out the objectiveness of it, to go, right, that's handball. They don't want to have to judge if it's handball.
It's black and white now with it. So I can take that point as well, where it is a case of where there's no kind of decision, because, you know, the classic handball was, oh yeah, it's unintentional, but how do you ascribe that to him? Oh, because it. You know, because you play it.
Yeah.
And it left a grey area.
How do you conclusively prove that a handball is accidental anyway? And
you can't.
The other thing now is with this handball thing is that, as a spectator sport, as we're talking about, like when the ball goes inside the penalty area now, it's almost insufferable, because it's like, well, someone's going down or someone's hitting the ball in someone's arm. There's going to be a decision here no matter what. Like, it's all about now getting into the penalty box. You're like half a chance of scoring a goal here, even though if there's nothing on, like, Like many Champions League final, there's no conclusive evidence to suggest that he definitely meant that.
I didn't think it was handball at the time, like, but they're going a bit old school.
Did it hit his hand?
Yes.
Then it was handball.
But I'm now, but it is no, but the rule was at the time, they've completely changed it now. The rule is actually, because I read up on the weekend, now it does goes, if it hits your body and then hits your hand, like that situation by the letter of the law is handball by the new rules. I'm a bit more old school with it. You just think about it the way it was. That's a thing that we'll all have to get used to, both the spectators and people involved in the sport, that it's different now. And VAR or not VAR, that is handball
but
anymore.
But the rule is absolute nonsense.
I totally agree.
Like, well, I'm not sure if you read Ken Early's piece, but he did a great job.
He did, it was brilliant.
Describing the fundamental issue here, and it's a clear, VAR was taken in, and I said this last week on the podcast, it was taken in for clear and obvious errors. And everything seems clear and obvious if the referee is watching it on a 4K replay that's going slow motion. Of course it's obvious then, but if it's not by human judgment, then you're taking away the complete aspect of the sport.
Not one Man City or Spurs player thought there was anything wrong with that Jesus goal. Like, and Larry started laughing.
You saw that for me summed it all up.
And you just look at what the City players are saying. They're saying, "Do you want us to cut off our arms now?"
Yeah, well, that's
ridiculous. That, I was going to say that.
I thought the City kind of reaction. I get the frustration, but I thought some of the stuff by Guardiola and some of the players, it was like, lads, did you not read on the new rules? Did you not read up on the new rules? These are
clearly going to be fraud.
They were taken by shock.
They're going to be frustrated.
Oh, I don't think
they scored an 80th minute winner.
But it is like that. Unfortunately, the rule has been brought in.
But do you not think any club's going to be talking about it the same way the City? Like,
no,
you really think that, say, Solskjaer, Pochettino, or any Frank Lampard, any of the top six managers, score an 80th minute winner against one of their top six rivals? One of their rivals for the title, and they're not going to be frustrated and say, they're just going to hold their hands up and say, you know what, rules are rules, VAR got it right. They're not
they showed an acceptance that they didn't understand the rules. That's what I thought was shocking.
Well, Kevin De Bruyne said he does not understand the new handball.
Yeah, well, that's unbelievable, because read the rule, it's there in black and white. I posted it over the weekend, and it's so, like, the law is bulletproof now, and it's probably, as Stephen said, introduced to allow a situation where somebody can look at it in a computer screen in a VAR situation and go, it's med contact, that's handball, end off.
Is that De Bruyne saying he doesn't understand the rule in terms of how it actually works, or he doesn't understand the point of it, or why?
My understanding from watching a couple of the interviews was that they were a little bit taken back. It was almost they didn't realise. I suppose in Premiership terms, it's not really. The Wolves one last the week before as well was, but it was the first high profile one where it came to light really. But that's the thing about it. And the scary thing is, with VAR, we still haven't even got into situations where I think it's really going to be controversial. I read up on it a lot during the summer. Like, you go back to, okay, I'll take this as I'm coming to speak now as a Liverpool fan. One of the key decisions from a Liverpool fan's point of view was Kompany not getting that potential red card against Salah for the two-footed lunge. It was a yellow card at the time. Mm. VAR in that situation won't deal with it, because that is classed by the laws of the game as not clear and obvious. So the situations like that where you would kind of think that, yeah, it would be useful for the referee to get a second opinion for having another look at it, because it happens 100 miles an hour. It's Salah's coming flying and Kompany's coming flying and the ball goes, and
you know why that's in though? Because if you do that for one foul, you're doing it for every foul. Because the opposition manager will go, well, hang on a minute, I think that foul's just as important as the other one.
But it's more from the referee's point of view that they don't have the facility to look at that.
No, the manager won't mean it, but he'll say it, but just in case.
That's why.
And that's the problem.
Well, that's why they need to have a think about it, whether they introduce a tennis-style thing where you get four challenges a game.
I would have thought that would make sense.
But even with the NFL, the last 2 minutes of a game, they automatically do it for every scoring play. So that would have got looked at
It's
anyway.
A slightly different...
But NFL stopped start anyway, though.
Yeah.
But it was a goal. Like, it stopped.
They have a commercial between players.
I know, but the play stopped.
It is not a spectacle. There's another sport that's not.
Hey, do you know what's not going to happen, though? This handball is not going to change. Like,
no.
They've made it now, so
yeah,
like,
and they're
gonna going away.
Grin and bear, and that's what I'm saying. There's going to have to be acknowledgement.
But they're not going to change it.
It's no.
They need to change it.
What's more likely, the backstop comes out or this?
I'm telling you, they won't, right? And also, it's the early days of VAR in Premier League, and we're all look back and remember when we all went mental at the start of VAR. And people were just going to start like accepting it, like reluctantly and depressingly. Like, football's changed forever now.
And yeah,
it has, like,
but it has
changed.
Though,
and they won't go back. Like, it's
no,
like
but
phones.
I remember even going back.
There's no going back.
to the Champions League stuff last season where VAR was brought in and every goal of the knockout stages was reviewed, you did have to, as a fan, you did have to hold yourself, but you did get used to it. I remember even going back to the Origi fourth goal against Barcelona. There was a bit of, oh, hang on a minute, is that really on?
Because everyone looked at it and went, was that legal?
There was a number of things there. One was like, have we actually scored a fourth goal against Barcelona? One was, what the hell has happened in the corner? One was like, are they actually going to allow it, etc., etc.? Is this really happened? But there was an acknowledgement, and you could tell by the fans, their initial celebration was muted, and then there was, when they went for the VAR check, everybody was kind of almost holding the spot, and then there was the big roar. But there was, you could see, even in the couple of knockout games that had been at Anfield, where fans had got used to that situation and then had accustomed to it. And did it really upset the nature of the day? Yes, of course, it would have been a different story had the goal been realised, but you could tell where the fans had got adjusted. We're still so early in the Premier League where it will take fans a bit more. I think it will settle in. This huge problem with it, and I'm still waiting for that kind of company silent moment where it's really going to kick off, and not even the handball, which is, you can argue about the rule, whatever, but that type of a scenario where we'll be looking for, and you'll be looking for it for your team, and then it's really going to kick off. That's when the fun's going to start.
My favourite new rule is the substitutes are allowed to leave at any point of the pitch when you're taking off, and I noticed last night in Wolves against Man United, Daniel James has been booed for the whole match. When he sprinted off in a normal place.
He wasn't going around the full.
His closest exit point was the other side by the Wolves fan. It's going to be unbelievable to watch that.
My favourite one is they've obviously seen that there's going to be a problem with VAR and people taking umbrage with it. So you're barred from entering the VAR room at all times if you're not authorised. The laughable thing about this is that the EPL's VAR room is centralised in Stockley Park. There isn't a Premier League ground near it for at least 13 miles. Mm-hmm. If a player gets to there in the middle of a game, he deserves a medal. Never mind a red card.
But if you're speaking, sorry to digress even more, but if you're speaking about in terms of rules and very, very quickly to touch on it, one of the biggest game changers really, I think, in the style of football, and probably VAR is going to be a huge difference to the game, but that's more of a kind of a general how we're accustomed to it. But the biggest change, I think, and I think it's the biggest change of any rule since the back pass rule in 92, is where from your own goal kick, you can receive it inside your box.
Yeah,
that is ground changing. We've already seen bits and pieces where you've seen different formations, you've seen dummy ones, you've seen the two centre halves in. Now it's the 50-50 element, and you've seen particularly the likes of Guardiola's team with Edison, and then Klopp has it with Alisson, where it was a bit more where you could press from the front, but you'd pay a 50-50 ball out to, now it's, you get possession of it straight away and you can have a whole series of moves, and you're going to see some goals and pre-planned moves straight away from goal kicks. That makes a big, big difference.
There was 15 minutes in the Arsenal-Burnley game on Saturday where Arsenal could not get out of their own half. Like, never mind Liverpool's high line. Burnley's line was the halfway line.
Oh, it was a full cork squeeze.
Yeah, and they couldn't get out. It was brilliant by Dyche. Brilliant. Like, they just pinned them in. And any time Arsenal got out, they were either on a counter-attack. Like, Aubameyang got called twice for offside for being a foot inside the Burnley half. It was ridiculous how they were all pressed in. But like you said, it's going to be interesting to see how many teams...
It's a game changer.
Especially against Liverpool or City.
Well, it suits City down to the ground.
Conceding.
Yeah. Because I was watching Ederson and the game against Tottenham, and he was pinging passes for 50 yards, and I know it's nothing new, I don't know why I was surprised by this, but I was just looking at him, I was like, if you had the positional awareness, you could play top six centre midfield
easy.
He's a better passer of the ball than most centre midfielders in the Premier League right now, and the big thing now is, especially when you have the teams like Burnley, you got the smaller teams like Brighton as well playing a high line from these, because they're able to push on further, because Do you go to the two men in the box, or do you sit back and let them play out and usually just park the bus? Ederson can ping, if you bring your high line up and bring it up to the halfway line, you can't be offside from goal kicks. And if you have a player like Sterling, player like when Sané comes back, Bernardo Silva at the right, Ederson pinging over the top of the midfield,
easy,
straight through on goal.
Yeah,
it's good. If you don't do that, you're allowing City to build from the back, and it suits those teams better than the lower league.
Almost definitely. It's probably going to define, like you saw the way Guardiola was, one of the first things he did with City was get rid of Joe Hart because he can't kick a football straight. He brought in his keeper, it was Bravo at the time, it didn't really work out. Eventually he got his goalkeeper with Ederson. You've seen Alisson, but all the top keepers will probably have to we remember even we spoke with Shane Supple here a while ago. He didn't like how the way the game was going because it's completely different. But it is going to go even more like that, where your goalkeeper is now your quarterback.
But every position is becoming multifunctional. Yeah. Like you say, goalkeeper. That's the best description for it is a quarterback. But like the typical number nine is becoming defunct. Like you can't just be a goal scorer like Romelu Lukaku scoring against, you know, teams outside the top six.
Top scorer.
It doesn't. Yeah, but it doesn't cut it. Like, and he's about 20 years too late for that type.
Imagine him from the '90s.
It comes with the grounds of having the best coaches and the best minds of football currently managing the Premier League. I would argue that the Premier League has undergone more changes in the last 5-6 years with Klopp and Pep Guardiola and Pochettino and Ollie and Conte. All these great football minds managing the top league, it has underwent more changes than the Premier League did in the first 15 years of its existence.
The standard of football now
If you look at the Premier League from 1992 onwards to about 2006, it was pretty... Well, actually, Jose Mourinho was probably the first change after Arsene Wenger, but it was basically 4-4-2.
Yeah.
Wingers getting wide and playing the ball. Whereas now you've got the change of inverted wingers, you've got the wing backs coming up thanks to Conte, you've got the goalkeepers controlling the game thanks to Pep Guardiola and Alisson, or Pep Guardiola and Klopp, Jagan pressing from Klopp.
Fullback.
Ashley Cole would have been so much more appreciated now.
Oh, for
like,
sure.
Because he retired during the week. So much more appreciated now. Yeah.
But
like,
winger, Ryan Giggs would not have made it in the Premier League.
He would have had to start off what he became, which is inside.
David Beckham inside. Would not have started for a top six club.
Forget about it.
Beckham would not exist. Like he was a right-sided midfielder.
But you saw towards the end of his career. I know his legs were going a bit, but Eriksen used to play him at right back just because he wanted to get the ball in and he couldn't. It just doesn't work like that. But you look at the amount of money Guardiola spent in fullbacks just to get it right.
All right, that was a rather abrupt end to this week's Team 33. We just had a couple of computer issues, actually. So we were also talking about VAR, also about the Pogba penalty issue as well. But that's it for this week's podcast anyway. If you want to listen in to the show in full, you just go to OTB Sports Radio or to the Off The Ball website or iTunes and you'll find everything there. But next week, the interview is with Colin Miller. He's written a book about the Seville Derby. Just one of the great cities to live in if you've ever had the opportunity or even the opportunity to visit. And it's just, I spoke to him this week and it was just an interesting chat about one of the great football cities. But anyway, that's it for this week's show. Take it away, Johan.